right, let's do this. Welcome to the podcast. My name's... Welcome to the podcast. My name's... Welcome to the pod... Welcome to the podcast. My name's... Welcome back to Zero Credits, the show where we talk about things. My name is Henry.
And my name is John.
And together we are Henry and John.
That's true.
Yeah, I don't lie. In the first 5 minutes of a podcast.
Outside of those 5 minutes, though.
Complete and utter lies.
Yep. So, how are you, Henry?
I'm very tired.
Same.
It's almost as though we both woke up at 8 a.m., go do improv for children.
It's almost like we... Exactly that. It's almost like we did improv for children for, like, an hour and a half.
An hour and a half in a room that was barely air-conditioned.
Yep.
It was full of flies.
Also children.
And oh, yeah, the children, of course. And the children. Oh, the children.
The children.
And when we say we did improv for them, we mean with them.
We did.
We did improv with and about.
I mean, okay, let's be real here. When you do improv with children, they're doing improv. Because, yeah. Listen, they don't get it, okay?
Their level of craft was abysmal.
Look, I understand not everyone can go to Juilliard, but these kids, pack it in.
Seriously, like, why were they even aspiring improvisational artists? They should be aspiring little kids.
It's not like their parents forced them to go there or anything.
You're right. They had their choice of summer entertainment. And they chose to fly Air, our improv troupe.
Yes, they chose to fly Air. Okay. What? Like an airline. Did not pick up what you were putting down. The funny thing about doing improv for kids is they like it when you move around a lot and scream.
And die.
And say the word Minecraft. And they're not big fans of, like, downtime at all, so...
Or exposition.
We were basically clowns.
We were clowns.
For an hour and a half. Which is fine. Kids are fun. Whatever.
Kids can be fun. And one little girl got it. The one who was like, we're at a pool.
Yeah.
It's really hot.
Yep. That one little girl, super on it.
You want to grab a drink? Literally just, like, grabs one out of midair.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah. It was an experience.
It was fun. Some of those kids, though, man. Hey, Henry.
What, John?
Pretend like you're the front man. You're the master of ceremonies for some kind of improv group, and yeah. I'm a group of children, and you're asking me for various kinds of suggestions.
I'm here. Okay, we're gonna do a scene, and in this scene, we're going to need some objects, so name something that you wouldn't put in your mouth.
Minecraft.
Name something that's blue.
Minecraft.
Hey, alright, I'm hearing a lot of Minecraft. Name something you would do with your hands.
Walmart.
Where would you like to go when you grow up?
Minecraft.
Name a profession.
Chocolate.
Okay, I'm going to try answering the prompt I'm actually giving you.
Chocolate. All Minecraft. Right.
Oh, I would love to watch a scene about chocolate Minecraft.
Me too.
Is that, like, the world of Minecraft, only it's made of chocolate?
Yeah.
I would eat.
Chocolate Minecraft.
I would eat chocolate apples. Probably wouldn't harm. Okay, wait. Here's a weird, dumb question. The world's made of chocolate.
Uh-huh.
And everything's the same, only, the base material of the world is chocolate.
Mm-hmm.
So there are animals made of chocolate that can move around, they live and breathe and such.
Yes.
Would you still be a chocolate vegetarian?
Yes.
Okay.
I would be.
They don't feel pain.
Oh,
because they're made of chocolate.
Wait, are they capable of understanding that their chocolate lives are coming to an end?
I mean, I think if a chocolate animal sees, like, a marshmallow on a stick, they know what's up.
Yeah.
They need to get out of there.
Yeah, if they didn't run fast enough on their little chocolate legs, it's their fault.
But it's not meat, is my thing.
Oh, it's not the fact that it's meat.
It's chocolate.
No, I get that.
No, put that no, together. No. Everything's made of chocolate, John.
Oh.
So, like, it would be chocolate.
Oh, that totally. Yeah, I did everything. I don't know, that's definitely something I've been thinking about a lot lately.
Chocolate?
Improv.
Oh, improv.
Like, performances. The performing arts.
Does it have anything to do with the fact that we do improv?
Yeah.
Does it have anything to do with the fact that there was a big improv festival this past weekend?
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a third thing.
Does it have anything to do with the fact that we're trying to start our independent troupe?
No, it's not that one.
Oh.
It's actually the,
That we saw people who are leagues better than us?
Nope.
That the crushing depression is setting in because you're getting into your older age?
There you go.
Oh, is that true?
Pretty much.
Okay.
I'm currently facing down the barrel of, like, you know, real jobs.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm interviewing tomorrow. Hey, I got that second interview.
Woo!
I'm interviewing with a place that might not be... Financial planning for people, it's really easy to be evil, and sometimes you're encouraged to be evil. And maybe it's hard to be good in the world of finance, and I'm kind of bumping up against, like, there's this thing that could pay me money, and I might be incentivized to be a real awful person, and there's this thing that I really enjoy doing, which is, like, performing and acting and being on stage and stuff. And it's like, how long can those two things coexist, and how much of one thing do I want in my life versus another thing in my life?
Well, if you're gonna use your improv powers to make money, all I have to say is do it, because I don't have any money, and so at this point, my moral relativism is very skewed.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm in a position right now where I could pay rent for a month or two with no job. So it's easy to look at this job that's coming up and be like, oh, no, what if it's bad?
Yeah.
But I'm still going to try to get it, because I'm not dumb.
I mean, and you still, you really, at the end of the day of today, you don't really know what the job is like.
Exactly. And it so might be totally different than
what I
think.
It might be completely different.
Mm-hmm.
You might be selling financial plans to criminals.
You're right.
So it's okay to rip them off.
I thought you'd be like, the people who need it the most, criminals.
No, no. Well, my example was you might be selling financial plans to Nazis.
Mm-hmm.
But then I realized, one, Godwin's Law.
Yeah.
And then two, Nazis don't finance.
They don't.
They invest.
True.
Yeah.
True. I don't know. It's just something I've been thinking about, that whole the world is a dark, scary place and you do what you can to make money.
I mean, I was watching Game of Thrones this past weekend.
Yes.
And I realized a really weird realization, because all of the other shows I'm watching right now are money-centric.
Mm-hmm.
Like Silicon Valley, Mr. Robot, other example. And so I just realized that a certain character has, like, marched all this way with his army. I'm like, he doesn't have any wealth.
Mm-hmm.
He has no gold. And he doesn't need it, because he has a sword and an army.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, the alternative to going to a job and making money, doing something you might not want to do, is that you have to kill people to get what you want.
I'm okay with that.
You want to kill people?
Yeah.
I don't know, man.
Battle of the Bastards. I'm a bastard.
It was really good.
Yeah, total divergence from the books, though, but whatever.
No, at this point, there are no books.
They're not the same thing at all.
No.
They're not the same thing at
they
all.
They are not.
But, I don't know, I don't ever think I want to stop performing in front of people, I guess.
I don't think you should want to stop that.
But I don't know how long that's going to keep being a viable thing in my life.
I don't know either, I mean.
Yeah.
I've been trying to move away from this town for a year and half a year now.
Mm-hmm.
And my plan was always, when I moved, to kind of just drop off the face of the improv map and wither away and die. Improv speaking.
Like, yeah.
Die in regards to improv. And I was actually pretty okay with that. Which is a weird mental space to be in when you're still continuing doing improv. Mm-hmm.
When you're like, this is still a thing that I'm ostensibly caring quite a bit about.
And it's like, I see people who are better than me and I'm like, oh man, I'm not that good. But then it's like, well, I was just going to give up anyway, so why do I care that I'm not that good? And then I get into this weird, paralyzed mental block.
I mean, I think if you see people that are a lot better than you, and you think, hey, why am I feeling, like, jealousy about them being better than me? I think some part of you wants to be better. Like, some barely below-surface part of you wants to keep doing the thing and keep improving on the thing you care about.
You're probably right.
And I mean, the great thing about the thing that we do is it's something that you never really have to quit.
Yeah.
Because there are improv groups all over. You can always make one. People are always interested in it. You can always teach a class or take a class.
Why would I want to learn how to do improv? I'm already a master.
You're right.
Yeah, we're more than 5 minutes out, so I can lie.
Yes,
now.
Perfect. But no, there's for a while I was definitely considering improv to be this thing that I just do for fun, and I'm gonna drop it because it's a nice way to meet people and whatever. But I've come to really care about it a lot, and the idea of dropping it is really, like, existentially unfulfilling.
Well, I mean, it's only really one day a week.
Yeah.
It's not a lot of time.
It's like 2 hours, one day a week.
Yeah.
It's not a huge investment at all, and it makes me feel a lot better. It's made me a better person.
So I think you should stick with it.
I think you should stick with it.
For the foreseeable future.
I think you should stick with it.
You should stick with it for the foreseeable future.
Same.
Yeah, you think that too. Good.
No, you should stick with it for the
foreseeable future. We're not talking about... This was all about your thing.
Okay, fine.
I'm quitting.
Fine.
I quit improv.
Okay. That made me sad.
Nah, we'll
the conversation made me sad.
We'll see what happens.
Yeah.
Hey, John, I do have one question, though.
What is it?
What are we doing?
Improv. Nope. We're not.
We're going to set up a little improv scene for you where... No, I'm just kidding.
Okay, so what this game is called Party Quirks.
There's only two of us.
And Henry's returning something. And and I'm the clerk. What's he returning? A bag of marbles. A bag of marbles.
No, I haven't.
Henry hasn't heard a word.
All right.
Let's play it out.
I hear it.
Boop, 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 doop. I'm a shop. I'm in a shop.
Ring, ring. I'm opening the door. There's bells above the door.
Hello.
Oh, hi. Let me walk all the way over the counter where I can actually hear you.
Blomp, 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 blomp.
Why are you hitting the desk with your hands and going blomp, blomp?
I'm simulating walking sounds.
Oh, that's weird because you're standing still. Let me walk over. Blomp, 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 blomp.
Hello.
Oh, hi. Hello. My name's Ralph McGinnis.
My name's Hollister Cromwell.
I don't need your name. I'm here to return this item.
I feel like now that we both know each other's names, we can grow as characters.
Oh, I didn't listen to you, Mr. Cromwell.
What are you returning? A bag of marbles.
It's super uncanny that we both said it at the same time.
Meisner.
You want to hear a story about how I got these bag of marbles?
Oh, flashback style.
Why are you making horse noises and saying flashback style? Do you want to hear the story or not?
Yeah, let's hear it.
All right. Oh, boy. I'm young Ralph McGinnis, and I'm 8 years old, and it's a Tuesday at 4 p.m. Oh, I hope no one takes my toy trucks and gives me a bag of marbles in exchange for them.
Haha, I'm the devil.
Oh, boy.
Give me that thing you said and have this thing I forgot.
I've always wanted to meet someone famous.
Goodbye.
Bye. Woo-doo-woo-doo-woo-doo. Flash forward. Woo-doo-woo-doo-woo-doo.
That's a good story.
Yeah, it turns out it was the devil that took my trucks and gave me a bag of marbles. And
ha! Turns out the devil really did go down to Georgia. Sand scene! We're in the desert.
Alright, we're in the Georgian desert. I got a bag of marbles. Anybody here have any questions? How about you, Mr. Cromwell?
I'm the devil.
Oh, Mr. Cromwell, the devil.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to trek through this desert and find our way to the lost treasure of a Beta Loca.
No.
Okay. We're going to trek through this desert and find the other lost treasure of Molche Nogre.
Perfect.
All right, Molche Nogre, everybody. We got to turn west now. We were heading east.
West.
Thank you, Mr. That is... The direction we're traveling in now, we have to double back, go back all the way that we came, because we were going to that other treasure, but now we gotta go all the way, okay, everybody, let's walk together. West. Alright, we're here at the treasure, and we've dug it up, and it's beautiful and golden. I've got a bag of marbles. Does anybody have any questions?
I have a question.
You, Mr. Cromwell?
I'm the devil.
Oh, hi, the devil.
No, I'm also Mr. Cromwell.
Oh, hi, Mr. Crowley.
The twist was that I was the devil.
Oh, do you want a marble?
Gulp. Choke.
Doctors! Save the okay, there's no doctors. We're in a desert.
And scene!
Man. Wow.
That was...
Now you can tell how good we are.
That was some high craft.
Man, I can't we just... Wow. Mm. Man. Mmm.
I don't know if you guys know this, but we did group mind exercises for a few hours before the podcast.
Yeah.
So we really, we tuned in on each other's frequencies pretty well.
That's why we both said bag of marbles at the same time.
It's uncanny.
Yeah. Almost as though that both of us knew what it was when we walked into the store in the scene.
We knew just by looking each other in the eyes. That's how well we communicate.
We're just like TJ and Dave.
We've been doing improv for 20, 30 years.
Yeah, even though we're only 10.
Years old.
That's a lie. Because it's past 5 minutes.
You're right. You're so right.
Man.
Man.
I've already asked, what are we doing?
Yeah.
Oh, good.
I said...
I'm glad.
I'm
glad this is where we are in the podcast.
Have you been thinking of any existential crises?
Here's an existential crisis. If someone comes in to, like, a service called, like, the Writing Center,
mm-hmm.
and they are just terrible at writing, and I don't feel like helping because it's an hour before I leave, I'm really tired and I haven't had lunch yet. This is more of an ethical dilemma.
Oh, one of your classic Henry's ethical dilemmas.
Is it okay... to, like, just say, yeah, that writing's great. Even though you really want to tell them they need to rewrite it. Also, it's due in a day, so it's kind of their fault for waiting this long.
I'd say that's 80% wrong.
20% right?
20% questionable.
Oh.
I mean, yeah. It's their bad for waiting that long and coming to you when it's too late.
I'm not saying I ever do this. It's just sometimes I feel the temptation to be like, look, obviously you don't give a fuck.
Mm-hmm.
So why should I give a fuck even though it's my job?
Yeah, if they come to you with something like that so soon,
yeah,
like preceding the deadline, that's their fault.
But then, I always do a full session with them. I'm not trying to say I shirk my duties. It's just sometimes I wish I could shirk my duties.
Shirking duties can be fun.
Yeah. Why am I so quiet on the waveform?
I think it's because you were talking about shirking your duties and you were ashamed.
You're right. That didn't do anything.
You're right. Anyway.
So, John.
Yeah.
What's up in your world, buddy?
Interviewing for jobs.
Okay.
It's hot.
It's very hot.
I've been procrastinating real bad about a lot of stuff.
Like what?
Like studying things that I need to study before I go in for my next interview. It's not much.
Do they give you like a homework sheet?
It's like a pamphlet.
About?
Like the services they offer, and they were like, no, study this and write down questions. I don't really have questions. It's all pretty self-explanatory.
Ooh, you got to go in with questions.
I'm going to try to.
You have to go in with questions.
I'm pretty sure that is actually a thing that people tell you to do for interviews.
If you don't ask questions, it looks like you're not invested, or you're a know-it-all, or you're telling them, hey, I don't need your help.
Or if you go in and ask dumb questions, they'll be like, what a dummy.
But they can mold a dummy into a chimp that can answer a phone.
Oh, nice. Because that's what I signed up to be.
Yeah.
Was a chimp dummy.
I mean, really, as far as my experience goes of interviews and corporate jobs or just any jobs in particular, it's just really this, like, how dumb of a person can we get
mm-hmm.
and pay them as little as possible to do this very simplistic task and then... As they worked there, we had more and more tasks until suddenly they're doing more work than any other one person in the office.
Nice. That seems crooked.
That's how I would run my business.
Oh, is this one of your ethical dilemmas?
Here's an ethical dilemma. Why is it okay that the salary of an employee really is determined by the salary they had at their last job?
Wait, is that a question or an ethical dilemma?
It's an ethical dilemma on their part.
Yeah, why is it that salaries are so different between people and that it's frowned upon to discuss salary?
Well, I know why it's frowned upon to discuss it, because your bosses don't want you to know what other people around you are making for the same or even, like, a lesser job.
Mm-hmm. Like someone who is less qualified than you making, say, $10,000 a year more.
Yeah, And there's a weird thing where it's like, okay, I had a job and I made $12.35 an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm applying for a new job. And so, like, the base rate that they want to give me is, like, a dollar above that.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little bit more than I got at my last job. But I can earn promotions over time and maybe get even more money. So I put in 2 years hard work, and I get up to that, you know, $14.25 an hour. And then they hire someone new, and I accidentally see her pay stub or whatever, and she's making $20 an hour for the same job I had 2 years ago.
Hmm. It's because they're paying you as little as they believe they can.
Yeah, but why? Why is that a thing that we allow?
Because in the United States of America, we built up a... It's a culture of wage ambiguity. It's very frowned upon to discuss how much you make. And when you create a culture that it's frowned upon to discuss how much you make, it becomes difficult for people to have, like, wage parity.
Yeah.
Or salary parity.
Yeah.
Like, if you are discouraged from knowing how much your fellow employees make, it's very easy for the company to be like, okay, you have blinders on, you have no idea how much anyone else is making. You were working this one job for $12 an hour, so $15 is going to seem, like, great.
I mean, as a person who sucks at selling themselves just because I'm very humble, and also I'm just really crap at negotiating, I just feel like I shouldn't be potentially taken advantage of just because I don't feel like being like, hey, yeah, I'm going to lie and say at my last job I got $18 an hour.
I think that the culture of lying that is required in basically any interview process really messed up.
And
the fact that you basically have to lie to sell yourself correctly.
I don't participate in that, and I feel like that's sort of affected my chances at getting the job.
Yeah, and it will.
Why?
Because it's horrible. Because we live in a world of liars and thieves and cheats.
I keep applying to jobs in another city,
mm-hmm.
even ones that say local candidates only. And for a while I was using a local address,
mm-hmm.
and even then, I got called into an interview. It's like, we saw that you used a local address, but it says you're still working at this campus in another state. It's like, so what's up with that? I was like, oh, well, I am working there. Since I'm not going to lie to you and say, oh, I left them when I'm still getting a paycheck
from
them. You were
like, I'm working there and I use a local address, so you would consider me because I'll move down there.
Yeah, exactly.
Did you tell them that?
Pretty much. I'm like,
that's okay.
I'm looking to relocate, you know, provided I can find a job.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, I started adding a caveat to the end of my cover letters that says, like, P.S., I will admit I do not live in this city currently. I'm looking to relocate via my own means, provided I can find employment.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not trying to pull one over and say, like, hey, you guys owe me a relocation fee.
Yeah.
I just need a job in another city.
I don't know. I can't relate to you entirely much because, you know, I've only been looking for a job for about a month. But there's a prevailing feeling of just you need to lie because no one wants you.
Yeah, nobody wants to hire anybody, and yet they keep posting want ads.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like want ads should be reclassified to we can't get by anymore without somebody in this position.
I get very, very sad with the people I talk to. It's like, you just don't want to hire me is the thing. Like, you're expecting me, like, it's an entry-level position, but you call me on the phone, so you want 3 years of experience. That's like, make up your mind!
Yeah,
did you want to hire me or not?
I hate that.
It's simple.
Yeah, I've seen things like entry-level position, like junior copywriter or something like that. And then it says, yeah, 3 to 5 years experience. Preferable all of these, like, really cool certificates and such that you would earn by being in the job. It's like, so you want to look, you want to find somebody who's already good at the job.
Yeah.
So why, I mean, entry level.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I'm good at it because I've never done it.
I mean, I saw a Facebook post today from someone who just graduated with a master's in education.
Okay.
And it was basically an open letter that was like, I know for a fact that I'm qualified for an entry level position, so why will no one hire me?
Yeah.
I paid for a master's.
I mean, I've got the same thing. Like, I have a master's, and it's just like, I should be getting more consideration than I am.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like the Masters alone shows, like, I'm dedicated, I'm a hard worker, I will stick with it to, like, earn the thing or do whatever work is necessary beyond what was asked of me. And it's just, like, I get maybe an email, so I'll apply to, like, 3 jobs a week, and then the amount of responses I get is about 1 per month.
Yep.
They don't even get back to you.
They don't.
There should be a law that says they have to get back to you.
Because, I mean, how are you supposed to continue on your life if you're waiting for someone to... I've had jobs get to a point where I'm like, there's... Obviously, they're not going to get back to me, because it's been a month. And then they call me, it's like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
How did it take you a month to do this?
My current... The last interview I had was a month ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm still waiting to hear back, yay or nay.
And sometimes it can take, like, 2 or 3 months for them to get back to you.
And it's just like, you guys seem like you were put out. Because, like, in the interview, they were like, yeah, we got people working overtime shifts. They don't want to work because we're down a person. So it's like, oh, so you're looking for someone ASP. And they're like, well, we're waiting for the higher-ups to tell us how long this interview process is going to be.
Yeah.
I'm like, I'm right here.
I'm here now.
Hire me.
I
want the job, even after you explained how boring it's going to be.
Mm-hmm. I don't know, this is something I don't explore a lot on the podcast, but I've been real bummed out about this stuff lately.
Yeah.
And I mean, you have been too, and you have greater reason for being bummed out about it. But like...
Oh, why? Because I'm worse off than you?
No, you've just been trying... Because
you're better than me?
You've been trying for longer.
You're right. Sorry, I'm just going to pick fights with everything you say today.
That's okay.
No, it's not!
God damn it. Yeah, I don't know. Whatever. Interview tomorrow, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, just prepare. Don't forget to wear, you know, your business slacks and your lucky shoes and your little hat with the little spinny thing that shows that you're still youthful.
Maybe I'll wear a tie.
Yes.
Didn't wear a tie last time.
I always wear a tie to interviews.
I'll wear a tie.
Even for my Books a Million interview.
Nice.
I was just like, yeah, I know I'm overdressed, but this shows that you're gonna hire me.
Yeah.
And they did. And what a mistake that was.
Yay.
For me.
Oh.
Not on their part. No, I was good at that job. I just hated it.
Man, if I could just work, like, a job that paid me, like, $13 an hour, that'd be great.
Yeah. Because that $13, $14, $15 around there for full time, that's a good amount of money.
That's like, I can save money and get out of here.
Do it.
I just...
Blow this Popsicle City.
If I could take one thing back...
What would it be?
And everyone says this, I would take back, like, 10 years of my life.
Okay.
And, like, care more about the coding stuff I did, and stick with it, and make it a thing.
That's funny. If I could go 10 years back, I would go into computer science.
Because it's, like, it's not easy. It's not an easy job.
No, but it's... There's employment everywhere for
that. There's employment everywhere. It interests me. And, like, I still do coding stuff, and I'm getting back into it, but it's like, what's the point? Like,
I would just go straight up into IT.
But, like, by the time I learn anything about coding, all those jobs will be filled. No one's going to want me anymore. So, like, why even
care? No, no, I watch Silicon Valley. There'll always be room for coders.
I mean, I do think going into the future, like, it's going to be the baseline skill.
Yeah.
It's going to be the thing people are supposed to know. And I don't know why I'm not trying harder to learn it.
I think it'll always be... There'll always be some level of... It will always be valuable, because people will never... I disagree with you, I guess.
Mm.
I don't think it will be a base skill. I think it'll always be a valuable asset, because people aren't willing to sort of sit down and learn how to code.
Yeah. I mean, I just wonder if eventually coding will be taught like math. Everyone will have a basic knowledge of it.
I'm not sure. For my honors program, we did have to take, I forget what they called it. It might have been just computer science, and we learned how to code Java.
Mm-hmm.
But we all had to take, everyone in the honors program had to take it, and we all did. And I don't think any of us went on to do anything with coding.
Mm-hmm.
Because it just didn't interest us.
Mm-hmm.
But I can Java you up a hello world.
Yeah, I need to get back. I've been doing some of it. I need to do more of it. Are you familiar with the concept of,
inevitability?
Mauvaise foi. Bad faith.
It sounds familiar, but...
Most people have, like, bumped up against it, but, the general idea is that you, like, tell yourself convenient lies even though you know the truth.
Okay, so, like...
You create a faith even though you know something's true, like... The classic example is, like, let's say that, like, a man and a woman are in a relationship, and the man knows for a fact that the woman is not attracted to him sexually, but values his companionship. And the woman knows for a fact that the man only values her for her body, but she values her mind, right?
Okay.
They both tell themselves a convenient series of lies to make living together possible.
Yeah.
And mauvaise foi is something that can, like, fester and rot over time, and as that faith goes away, you don't have a net under you anymore, because this faith system that you had that's based on lies that you forgot was a lie isn't there.
Gotcha.
And everyone suffers from it, everyone does it. And it could be argued that at the root of whenever you make a decision that you know isn't the right one, that's mauvaise foi. You're telling yourself a convenient lie to do the thing that's easier or more convenient to not do the thing that's right. And I feel like I've been doing that a lot. Like, throughout my life, like, I can look back and see moments where I'm like, I should have learned this, I shouldn't have stopped doing this, I should have continued to do this thing that made me happy. And I'm at a point in my life where I could, you know, time travel's not possible.
Nope.
I might be able to fix some things now, or at least get started on some things. So I could. Why am I not?
That's a good question. And I think to answer that, you just gotta face the fact that humans are lazy, lazy creatures. And as we get older, the lazier we get.
Mm.
And that's not true for everybody. There are people who continue to develop and improve their entire lives.
Mm-hmm.
Those people are superhuman.
I want to be one of those. I want to stop getting slower and dumber.
According to some psychologist, I think, if you just keep lying to yourself that you are one of those people, you will eventually become one.
I mean, there's a growing body of science that says that fake it till you make it is a totally appropriate life strategy.
Yeah.
That self-deception is healthy.
So that maybe you need to start to stop doing your bad faith lies and start doing your fake it till you make it lies,
mm-hmm,
to get you on the track to becoming the next Steve Wozniak.
Yay, I'll be Steve.
He coded, right?
Yeah.
All right, Steve Wozniak.
I mean, I just need to care more about things that I know matter.
Yeah.
I guess. And I guess everyone could stand to do that.
I feel like at a certain point around when you start turning 30 or so, a magical little fairy flies by and restores your ability to care in certain things.
Mm.
I feel like, you know, we get one little bump or dosage when we're born, mm-hmm, and that lasts us all the way to about our mid-20s. Well, a lot of us become, like, cynical or jaded, and it's hard to care about things. And then hopefully, this is the optimist in me,
mm-hmm,
we get another little bump that carries us out until retirement,
mm-hmm,
by the time we get to, like, 30 or so.
Yeah,
one can only hope.
I think that's absolutely true, and I think it happens maybe 3 or 4 times over the course of a life. Like, I know, I've read stories of people who are like, I was in the Marines, and then I had these manual labor jobs, and then I learned to code or learned this different skill, or I like wanted to be an artist at like 40, 45, 50, and they make a bunch of money and live really happily and save money now.
Yeah.
That's like, if I did that now and I backdated all of that future success, think of the success I could have now in the future.
But you probably wouldn't know any of the people you know now.
Yeah, and like, I don't...
You wouldn't know me.
I don't... Yeah, I guess.
There would be no zero credits.
That's definitely one of the things, because the life I have now is the happiest I could possibly be, I know for a fact, because I can't know anything else for a fact.
He said the magic phrase, now I must end him.
No!
But yeah, I mean, I guess you couldn't know if you would be happier in another life because you haven't lived that life.
But I mean, I wouldn't want to lose anything that I have now. I just want to have things on top of it.
Which, you can't have your cake and eat it too.
Yeah.
It's either you're happy now or you're in a cubicle coding for the rest of your rich days.
I mean, I might... You say that, but I'm going to be in a cubicle for the rest of my days anyway.
No, you're going to be in an office.
You're right.
You said you might get an office.
I might get an office. I'm not getting an office. It's definitely a thing that maybe I should invest more in the succeeding now and do the things that... Man, I learned... Did I ever tell the story on Zero Credits about math?
Wait, you're going to have to be a little more specific.
Okay, so I was really bad at math all the time I was growing up. I was good at it in like elementary school, but whatever. In high school, I just cheated, didn't do it. I was homeschooled, so I could cheat and not do it. But then when I got into college, I got put in like remedial math class.
Yeah.
It's like, this shit's for the birds. So I went to Khan Academy, and I learned everything up through Calculus 2 over the course of a summer. I learned everything. I couldn't stop. It was crazy. Why can't I do that anymore?
You need to be put in remedial coding.
Apparently.
You have to be challenged by the outside world before you rise up to the occasion.
Because once I like self-actualize and tested out of that class, and like tested out basic algebra, I guess I didn't have a goal anymore. And I guess that's why I stopped.
I guess.
I don't know.
You gotta get back into the game, bruh.
I do. I have a Chromebook. It's never been easier.
I've got a Chromebook. Why does that make things easy?
Because it has, like, a lot of battery life, and you can just take it anywhere and be like, haha, I'm coding in a tree. Hee-hee-hee.
I guess on that uplifting note, we can afford to take a little bit of a break.
Let's take a break.
Let's all pause and imagine the glorious image of John coding in a tree.
Sounds good to me.
Yee-hee.
I'm coding in a tree. I'm a code elf.
We'll be back after a word from our sponsor.
Uh-oh, a python.
Oh, hi there, John.
Hi there, Henry.
Have you ever wanted to be happier?
Constantly.
Oh, well, do I have some news for you?
Please.
You can't force yourself to be any happier than you are right now.
What?
But, however, using this trick that doctors hate.
What, doctors hate it? That must be good.
In 3 to 5 months, you'll be a happier person.
How?
Just smile. Just force yourself to smile.
Really?
Just at random points during the day.
Is this real science?
This is actually a real thing that I read about.
You just force yourself to smile and you get happier.
If you're smiling, it's like a fake it till you make it. If you put a smile on your face and you feel those muscles like straining to do the smile thing, if you got a good disposition, if you act like you're happy, eventually, supposedly, you will be.
What if they just look at how often people smile and they're like, they must be happier.
I don't know science.
How do you measure happiness?
With money.
Oh, so I'll get money if I smile?
Yeah.
That's what all those street harassers keep telling me.
Exactly. However, I do need to suggest a change in profession.
Oh?
Be a stripper.
Okay.
Just be a stripper.
Smile more and be a stripper?
Smile more, be a stripper. Also, have you ever considered turning into a woman somehow?
Not yet.
Oh, you should, because if you're a woman stripper who smiles, boy, does the happiness just roll in.
So much happiness.
Man, what a good life in the world we live.
Thanks, hateful doctors.
Hateful doctors, they got stuff for your face to make you happy. It's pills.
I thought that was a good idea.
Did you think it was a good idea? Do we need to do another?
What
did
just happen?
An ad.
Oh.
We watched an ad.
Nice.
It was ad.
Speaking of what did.
Yeah.
You.
Watch.
What did you watch?
What did you watch?
This is a segment where we talk about things that we have experienced with our eyes.
Eyes.
And not solely with any other sense.
Take it, other podcasts, and also maybe food.
You can see food. Lobster.
Anyway.
So, what did you watch, Henry?
I have watched the entirety of season one of Mr. Robot.
Oh, the USA original.
Yes.
Inexplicably.
And surprisingly.
So, what is it?
It's by Sam Esmail?
Sam, that sounds really familiar.
I don't know what else he's done, and I'm not sure I'm pronouncing that right.
Sam Esmail?
Well, it's like E-S-M-I-L.
That sounds familiar.
Yeah, I don't know what else he's done.
But
he created it, wrote it, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about this disenfranchised hacker who just is seemingly trying to get through life. But he hacks literally everyone in his life.
Oh.
That's how he processes the world.
Mm-hmm.
Through their secret, like the information that you don't really give to people.
Mm-hmm.
So there's something with them, you know. The show never actually says what it is. Let me. I guess I should just tell you how the show is set up. There's an opening monologue done by Rami Malek, who plays.
Oh, I love him.
He's so good in this. He plays the main character, and the premise of the show is that we, the audience, are an imaginary friend that he is talking to.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
So we experience the world through his perception. So there's a company called E-Corp, who they've got their hands in everything. They're basically a big conglomerate. They own everything. You know, it's like the many-tentacled octopus or whatever. He has subliminally trained himself to always hear and say Evil Corp instead of E-Corp. And C. Like, even in their ads, who will see that?
Oh, weird.
So whenever you're following Rami, which is like 80% of the show, E-Corp is Evil Corp. And that becomes like hard to understand, because like he'll hear other people say Evil Corp, because they're saying, like, the actors portraying those characters will say it.
We'll say Evil Corp. But then if it's following other characters, it's E-Corp.
It's just E-Corp.
Interesting.
Which is something that, like, it's spelled out to you in the first sort of few minutes of the show, but it's done in a way that you don't really realize what he's saying. Because, like, he's watching a commercial for them, and, like, it flashes up real fast, like, a weird, like, subliminal thing that says, like, Evil Corp. And you don't know. I was like, oh, did he hack that in? It's only when you realize later that other people are saying it that you're like, oh man, wait. And then, like, other people don't say it because Rami's not in the scene, or his name's Elliot in the show. So Elliot's not in the scene, and that's when you put it together that he's hacked his own brain, man.
I like that they didn't necessarily spell that out.
Yeah, it's probably more spelled out than I realized, probably because I was falling asleep during the first episode.
Ah.
That's not any judgment against the show. I was just tired when I started watching it. But it's the cinematography is really good in that you are very uncomfortable pretty much throughout the entire show. Like, shots are taken from weird angles. There are some shots where it's like we only see the corner of the main character's, like, face while he's, like, talking to somebody or like moving about in the world. Everything seems, like, disjointed and off-putting, but then you gotta realize it's because we're in the perspective of this character, and this guy has something wrong with him. You know, I said he was a disenfranchised hacker. He might also have Asperger's.
Alright.
He's definitely a drug addict, and there's more things that you find out that are wrong with him.
Okay.
And that makes sense, like, it makes sense why the camera acts the way it does.
He sounds like an interestingly difficult protagonist.
He really is. And for a while, it's kind of like, well, there are other characters in the show, but he's not close to many of them at all. So it's like, you, the viewer, are the closest person to him in the show. Which gets really weird, because we don't exist in the show. So there are sometimes where, like, yeah, there's voiceover narration, and it's his inner monologue, and he asks us questions. It's like, did you catch that? Did you know? Are you holding out on me too? And it's just kind of like, dude, I'm just watching the show.
That's a very neat perspective.
Yeah.
For a show to force the audience to take.
It's a very interesting sort of piece of work, and I'm still like, you would have to see it to have this conversation. I'm still trying to parse a certain thing that happens in the show, because there are so many references to other great sort of works. That play with a protagonist whose mind is not, of course, like, in its best state, like American Psycho or like Fight Club. You know, it's playing with tropes, and it even, like, recreates certain shots.
Oh, neat.
From these movies and like narrative and stuff, where it's just kind of like, so do we trust Elliot as our narrator, or is it going to be revealed later that something we knew happened didn't happen? So there are some people who are theorizing that the entire show is not happening.
Oh.
That it's just in his head. And I think that's dumb and wrong, because you don't show an entire season of a show, and then, like, the creator, Sam Esmail, is saying it's going to be, like, about four or five seasons. It's like, you don't show that, and then at the very end say none of it happened.
Yeah, that'd be ridiculous.
Yeah, that would be, like, you know, Green Acres or whatever. Was it Green Acres?
Nope. But I know what you're talking about. The one with the snow globe?
Well, no, there was another one. There was another show. Okay, so St. Elsewhere is a good...
Yeah.
Are
you thinking of Dallas?
Not Dallas.
The one where the woman, like, wakes up at the end?
Was that Dallas?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, then Dallas, yeah.
Who shot JR?
Well, yeah. But Dallas ended with a woman waking up in her bed and just had the weirdest dream.
Yep.
I believe that
was Dallas.
Yeah, fuck that. Fuck that.
That's very dumb.
If that's what Mr. Robot turns out to be, dumb.
Yeah.
But I will
agree with you, that would be dumb.
I have more faith in Sam Ismail than that, because he delivered a really good first season of a show on a network that does not have a lot going for it right now ever since
the USA Network, of all things.
They let Psych go, and Psych was great.
Mm-hmm. But they let Monk go.
Monk was okay.
Monk was all right.
But no, anyway, so this is like the best thing to come out of that network in a while. So they're going to keep making it, hopefully. And they even gave it sort of like special privilege. The first and last episode of the season were 75 minutes long.
Okay.
Yeah. It felt like a whole, like, it felt like a movie.
Where does the name come from?
Mr. Robot?
Mm-hmm.
In the first episode... Elliot meets a person who does not give him a name, played by Christian Slater.
Oh, interesting.
Who has a
that's
jacket.
Where he went.
Yeah, that's where Christian Slater went. That and Archer. But he wears a jacket that says Mr. Robot on it.
Oh, okay.
So that's where that comes from.
Makes sense.
And there's a little bit of, you know, of course, there's intrigue and mysterium around this Christian Slater character.
And maybe, like... Rami Malek's character is a little bit of a Mr. Robot himself.
Maybe so. But don't take my word for it. Watch the series. It's free on Amazon Prime right now. Season 1 is.
I mean, like, because you made it sound like he has trouble, like, processing things. Yeah. Or, like, hacks his own brain.
He's pretty much a robot.
Okay. I look forward to watching this robot drama.
It's really good. Sam Elliott, that's not his name. Rami Malek does a really awesome job with it. Like, I don't know how he does it. I don't know. His eyes... I don't think he blinks in the entire series. His eyes are always completely wide. He looks like he's, like, strung out the entire...
He's very good at the bug-eye look.
Like, I mean, this was even better than Jake Gyllenhaal and Nightcrawler in that negotiation scene.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's that the entire time, but, like, I guess a little tuned down, because I think Elliot is a little more... likeable than that protagonist from Nightcrawler.
A not likable person in the least.
Yeah.
Nightcrawler's also good. So, Mr. Robot.
I highly recommend it. You could knock out the whole series in 3 days.
Where is it available to stream, I think you may have said?
Amazon Prime.
Fantastic.
Also
see Nightcrawler.
Also, that's on Netflix. Watch Nightcrawler.
And Mr. Robot. So, I brought a thing.
Where'd you bring it?
In my mind.
Oh, pals.
It's the movie Inside Llewyn Davis.
Inside Llewyn Davis.
Llewyn Davis. It is a Coen Brothers movie.
Oh.
The only Coen Brothers movie I had not seen up until this point.
When did it come out?
2 years ago, something like that. 2-3 years ago.
I didn't realize they released movies 2 years ago.
What?
I'm just kidding. It's a
What's
joke.
What's happening? But no, it follows the story of this New York-based folk musician in the early 60s, before the kind of Bob Dylan renaissance of folk music happened.
All right.
Llewyn Davis, who is based pretty heavily off of a 1960s, 50s and 60s folk singer, Dave Von Ronk, who never saw much success, but really upheld these traditions of traditional folk music. And it follows his... It follows his journey through, I believe it's a week. It's bookended by the same day. And his week goes forward of him having these various failures professionally and personally. And people have gone as far as to say that it's the last and maybe final movie in what people call the Coen Brothers Failure Trilogy. Which is Barton Fink... which is about, like, creative failure.
Okay.
And then A Serious Man, which is about personal failure.
Okay.
And then Llewyn Davis, which is potentially about, like, the world failing you.
Okay.
We were talking about Mr. Robot, how the main character is, like, interestingly difficult. Llewyn Davis as a character is very difficult. He's very prideful and he's very stuck in his ways.
All right.
And not in a he's a traditionalist kind of way, but essentially the meat of the movie comes off the fact that he used to be a member of a Simon and Garfunkel-esque duo. It was Davis and Timlin, I think.
Okay.
Mark Timlin was the person he also performed music with, and his partner died from a reason that you find out later, but he's basically an Art Garfunkel without a Paul Simon.
Yeah.
So he's drifting through life with people, essentially, they keep reminding him that his life is missing a huge piece, like... A huge theme of this movie is the lack of satisfaction, the lack of things becoming whole, because the movie keeps teasing you with these things that would make the situation whole and complete and satisfying, and always denies you.
Okay.
It always takes the thing away.
Yeah.
He travels with a cat. For the majority of the movie, he has a cat.
Don't tell me.
Called what?
The cat ends up being separated from him in some form or fashion.
Yes.
Yeah. What's the cat called?
The Gorfines cat.
The Gorfines cat.
The cat has a name that, if I told you, it would ruin a surprise.
Oh,
but,
Cancer.
the cat's name is Cancer. But no, traditionally fans, to keep the surprise, also there's ambiguity as to the cat's identity.
Okay.
So they just call it the Gorfines cat.
The cat's identity?
It's
a reincarnated person?
There's a lot of stuff about that cat. There's a lot of things you could read into the cat, which the Coens have never been above putting things in just to mess with critics.
Of course.
A lot of what the cat could stand for might just be to mess with critics.
Could be.
Because the cat goes through a lot of things.
This cat goes through a lot of things.
Yes. In his journey with Llewyn Davis.
What, does the cat, like, meet a girl and exchange numbers?
No. But
gets its heart broken?
The cat does go on an incredible journey.
Homeward Bound?
More incredible journey.
Are you confusing this movie with Homeward Bound?
Yes, no. But, you could definitely read a lot of things into the cat, but mostly the movie is just, it is, like, lockstep with denying your expectations, making everything circular, everything comes back.
Okay.
Everything, but not in a satisfying way, just in a circular way, not in a whole way.
Annoying.
And the movie is very melancholy. You could read it about being a movie about depression. I don't think there's been a Coen Brothers movie with this little color since The Man Who Wasn't There, which was in black and white.
Gotcha.
But the movie almost feels like it's in black and white. The color palette is extremely muted. Oscar Isaac, who plays Llewyn Davis, his skin in the 1961 winter in New York, which was a notoriously terrible winter... His skin is so pale. He looks like a vampire, almost.
Whoa. Okay.
And one of the things that keeps being revisited for his character is this hanging prize of a winter coat. He maligns not having a winter coat. His agent offers him a winter coat and then takes it back as part of a bribe. People offer him winter coats and he doesn't take them.
Wow. It's kind of like The Overcoat by Gogol.
Oh?
A Russian short storyist.
Yes.
Well...
I'm not familiar with it.
Briefly, there's this a Russian clerk in the government spends all of his money on this nice new overcoat,
mm-hmm.
and something happens, and somebody ends up stealing his coat,
mm-hmm.
and he wants it back. It was like someone higher up than him sees mm-hmm. the coat, wants the coat, takes the coat, fires him.
Mm-hmm.
So this guy, this clerk, wants it back. So like he stands out at night. Waiting for this cloak to come back,
mm-hmm.
You know, for the guy to come out and, like, he's like, give me back my coat. Ends up dying,
mm-hmm.
freezing to death in the All cold. Right. But the coat was so important to him, comes back to life.
Okay.
His corpse is, like, reanimated, and he's like, give me my coat back. And, like, I forget...
A coat revenant.
I forget sort of what happens, but he ends up getting the coat back and, you know, of course, dying again because mm-hmm. he was dead.
Yeah.
But, So, you know, it's like the whole focus is on this coat.
A lot of the movie, its focus is kind of diffused with its symbols, but the coat is definitely a symbol of his character, because people keep making comments about, like, oh, the winter's really bad, like, why don't you have a winter coat, go out with a coat. And, you know, he's dressed in a, like, a collared cardigan and like a corduroy jacket, what we in the South would consider very warm clothing.
Well, yeah,
but it's a New York winter.
Yeah,
but the coat's definitely part of it. The cat's part of it. But throughout the movie, it reaches such depths of sadness.
Yeah,
it's a very sad movie for a lot of the proceedings. And one of my favorite things about the movie, not to spoil any story beats,
yeah,
but early on in the movie you find out that a woman that he had slept with is pregnant. It's not like a huge deal, it happens. It is a huge deal, but it happens within the first 10 minutes, I think.
First 10 minutes?
And
spoiled it.
And they talk and he seeks to, like, arrange for her to have an abortion, which is illegal at the time.
Okay.
And then at the... like, the zenith of the movie, or the nadir of the movie, I don't know which one I'd call it, but it's the peak of his journey. It's when he is the farthest from home.
Gotcha.
He plays a rendition of The Death of Queen Jane, which is a very, very old traditional song about Jane Seymour having to have her child, like, cut out of her and dying. And it mirrors both his situation and the situation with the woman in his life. And this idea of something like being taken away and not being whole, because one of the things that's repeated in that song is like, if I lose the flower of England, I'll lose the branch too.
Whoa.
It is a super powerful moment. And it's just so strong, so like narratively focused in that moment. And then like it all comes back down to an original point because everything in the movie is circular.
Yeah.
And it's so good.
Cool.
It's a really good movie. Oscar Isaac's in it. He's great. John Goodman's in it.
John Goodman!
John Goodman is a part of a sequence of the movie that is almost like... Coens have this tendency to make movies that have these kind of protracted periods where they cut the ties with naturalism and things feel very surreal.
Yes.
Very dreamlike.
Yes.
And for a period, Llewyn Davis is traveling with this kind of almost Jack Kerouac-y, like, road poet... He's very beatnik, he's very anti-establishment, very anti-careerist, and he's driving around this jazz man who's played by John Goodman, and John Goodman's character he's very, like, structured, even though he's into jazz, he makes a lot of money, he's like a musical careerist, he's what Llewyn Davis calls a square because he made a career out of music.
Okay.
And... like, these two ideologues, basically, are traveling down this road that's always foggy. You never see what's very far in front of the car. They're always eating at restaurants with no people in them. Just exploring this relationship between, like, hip and careerist life. And it's so odd. It's really entertaining. And the way it ends is heartbreaking and great.
That sounds interesting.
When it comes back from, like, going out to sea in surrealism and comes back to reality, it's very stark and nice.
Yeah.
It's a very good movie. Really liked it. Definitely did not care for it as much as I do now when I saw it the first time. Wait. When I saw it the first time, I was very cold on it because nothing had sunk in.
Okay.
Like, I had appreciated, like, the moment I talked about with The Death of Queen Jane, and I had appreciated certain parts of it, but I didn't internalize what I had seen. And sometimes movies, they do that. It takes a while for you to realize what you watched.
Okay.
But, yeah. Inside Llewyn Davis, Oscar Isaac, other people, John Goodman.
Coen Brothers.
Very good movie that will bum you out a little bit. A lot, actually.
Well, yeah. There's nothing too cheerful about Mr. Robot either.
Yeah. Also, the movie... I can't say it.
You can't say it!
There's a thing in the movie that's really great that makes the entire movie that you had seen preceding it mean a lot more in a totally different context, and I don't think the Coens have ever done anything quite like that before.
Interesting.
There's a definite thing.
There's a thing.
But, that's the movie.
Wow, we had a sort of a thematic pairing for What Did You Watch Today?
In this very sad podcast, sad and difficult podcast, we had two sad and difficult things to talk about.
Hopefully people will stick with it.
Maybe that's why we've been feeling this way.
Well, in brighter news, we've got fan art!
Nice!
Fan art!
Yes, fan art. This fan art is... Could you describe it to the people, Henry?
Well, there were two of them.
There were two of them.
Mine's a blue canvas
thing. Mine is a purple canvas thing.
And there's some words that are white.
Mm-hmm.
And it says, 0 credits. Intercoin for banter.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we do here.
It's true.
And our name's Zero Credits.
Mm-hmm.
And we banter.
And who provided this this lovely real-life fan work to us?
This was Elric's cousin.
Or Eric.
Otherwise known as Eric.
Yes.
So thank you, Eric, for giving us our fan art. We love it. I have mine propped up on a desk because I don't feel like putting any more holes in my wall.
That's totally fair. You're not going to get that deposit back anyway.
Yeah, I mean, shut up. But no, I have it on display in my in the big room where we record.
Mm-hmm.
And John's is
at my girlfriend's house. I'll get it and put it on my wall. It's fine.
Just leave. You just leave your stuff all over town.
Yep.
You got mayonnaise out there. You got.
I'm a real rambling man.
Fan art just out twisting in the wind.
But thank you very much, Eric.
Yeah, so much. That's awesome. First fan art we've got.
And you know, if you guys want to send us fan art, we'll try to get a P.O. box set up or something.
Or something.
That'd be very cool if you send us things.
Yeah.
We'll talk about them.
But before we set anything up, you guys got to start emailing us and Twittering us more.
Yeah. We need stuff to talk about.
Yeah, come on. Get in contact to us on the Twitter.
We're a snake eating its own tail.
Go ahead and Ouroboros.
Yeah, except we're actually like, the thing about the Ouroboros is that it's infinite, but if it keeps eating, it gets smaller and smaller.
But it's still infinite.
And that goes boop boop.
Infinitely.
You're right.
Yeah.
On Twitter, contact this Ouroboros.
Contact us at ZCPCWHJ.
On Twitter.com.
Or email us at
zerocreditsisapodcast@gmail.com.
And come on, if you listen, let us know.
We hear you.
We want to.
Out there, we hear you.
You definitely hear us. We want to hear you.
If you know what? Send us an email and be like, would a website help? Answer that question.
Yeah, do we need a website? We need a website. We got a blogger.
Tell us how we can reach more people.
Do we need a Patreon? No.
If we need a Patreon, let us know.
Do we need a Facebook page?
If you would donate to a Patreon, let us know.
Tell us if we need an Instagram.
Tell us if we need an Instagram. If you tell us to do something, we'll probably do it. Shape our future. Help.
Yeah, you take a stake in the podcast you listen to. You give us some advice back. Help us.
Strike a spade into that bubble and crude.
Yeah, what he said, only make sure it makes sense. Bubble and crude?
Like, they put a stake in the ground of Zero Credits, and then just bubble and crude oil comes up.
Oh, black gold.
Black gold. They get that black gold out of this podcast.
Wait, you want them to take all the valuable things out of the podcast?
No, it's mutual black gold.
Wait, so they place their stake in, and together we reap the reward.
We love the stake, they love the oil.
But it's their stake that makes the oil. Okay, so the oil is the podcast.
Not valuable to us.
No, that's not what I mean.
Yes.
Right now, we have a trowel.
Mm-hmm.
Not to call a trowel. We have a trowel and we're scooping up like spoonfuls of oil mm-hmm. and sending them out.
Yeah.
They give us their steak and they stake it and then suddenly podcast black gold spray it all over the nation.
We don't even need to send it out.
No,
we're famous.
We'll refine it.
Woo, Texas tea.
Yep.
Woo!
Is that what you were getting at?
Yeah.
Alright, so we stake this vampire, and let's go ahead and do it.
The world is a vampire.
Ban on a ban on a ban.
I guess we should say goodbye.
Probably.
Well, I'm...
That's been John.
And I've been John.
And together, that's been John.
And that's been Henry.
Oh, I'm Henry.
You're Henry.
This has been Zero Credits.
I'm gonna go to sleep.
I'm going to fall asleep. Bye, everybody.
Bye.